This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to In Case You Missed It. I'm Angela Owens. On today's program, Old Blue Eyes and Bob Hawke made history when, over a box of cigars and expensive brandy, they saved Frank Sinatra's 1974 tour of Australia from disaster. The union had black-banned him for his misogynistic diatribe against female journalists.
The broads who work in the press are the hookers of the press. Need I explain that to you? I might offer him a buck and a half, I'm not sure.
We find out the connection between Harry Potter and the Bible. If you've noticed, there's been a lot of talk in the media about the American political right. Stick around to find out what's happening to the political left. And all you've ever wanted to know about black holes with Dr. Carl. In 1974, Frank Sinatra came out of hibernation for his world comeback tour, which included Australia. Fascinated by the Hollywood superstar, the media here was relentless in its pursuit of him for an interview. But Sinatra refused to talk to them, and growing frustrated with the press, he lashed out at reporters, female reporters in particular, in a poisonous on-stage spray. Unions, upset with how their press corps members were treated, black-banned the singer, refusing to work on his concerts or refuel any plane he may have been on, leaving him stranded in a luxury hotel in Sydney. James Viver from The History Lesson has revisited the whole saga. We pick up the story from the hotel room when spaghetti was being cooked and the telephone was about to ring.
I met him in the foyer of the hotel. And he said, John, I'm cooking spaghetti and salad in your magnificent kitchen. Why don't you join us for dinner? With Frank being the chef.
John Pond was the PR manager at the Boulevard Hotel. He was in charge of giving Sinatra the treatment that he was used to. But with the crooner now grounded and under siege, his entourage appealed to John for help.
I was in the middle of spaghetti and the phone rang. Oh, it's for John Pond. It's the Prime Minister. And I'm talking to Gough Whitlam, our Prime Minister, on the telephone. He said, there's only one man that can solve this for you.
The President of the ACTU, Mr. Bob Hawke.
It was Bob Hawke.
Mr. Bob Hawke.
President Hawke of the ACTU.
And so Hawke had inserted himself well into this whole thing.
Union's concern and Frank Sinatra wished to see the situation amicably resolved.
Sensing the opportunity for a PR win for the unions, Bob Hawke flew to Sydney to try and broker a truce. Concert producer Robert Raymond took the ACTU chief up to the presidential suite to meet with Sinatra and the star's lawyer, Mickey Rudin.
And Frank made a disparaging remark towards Bob, and that was enough. Mickey said, look, I'll call you. Leave us. So I left and went down to my suite at the other end of the hall and waited.
Not wanting to miss out on the action or the scotch, champagne and chicken sandwiches, 15 union representatives had also converged at the hotel to be a part of the negotiations.
And every time they came up with a document, they'd come down to us maybe each half hour or so and say, what do you think of this? And the unions would go, nah, not strong enough. In the end, Mr. Hawke whispered in my ear and said, let's get this thing to an end, John. Do what you can, your end. I'd said to them, look, if we can solve this in the next 15, 20 minutes, we can have a concert on Saturday. I'd like to invite all you guys to the concert with your partners, and I'll be able to organise accommodation with our compliments. They came into the room, they read the statement. One person said, no, that's not good enough. Everyone else says, shut up. And that was the statement. All was solved. That was it. There was a concert the next night.
The The summit between the unions and Sinatra's lawyer, Mickey Rudin, had gone long into the night. And those talks had taken their toll on Bob Hawke. Concert producer Robert Raymond.
So, of course, the sense of relief is unbelievable. Mickey knew how to get to Bob Hawke. That bottle of Courvoisier. He was half pissed, I think he'd have to admit that. I mean, he was almost legless, to be honest.
The deal was done. Now, it was time to talk to the waiting press.
Frank Sinatra did not intend any general reflection upon the moral character of working members of the Australian media. With this statement, it is the desire of all concerned that the Australian people can now enjoy the fulfilment of the remainder of Frank Sinatra's scheduled program in this country.
That was archival audio of Bob Hawke when he was ACTU president. So if you want to find out all about the events that led to that extraordinary conclusion, download the History Listen podcast. We'll also put a link to the episode on the In Case You Missed It website. At the height of its popularity, Harry Potter was bitterly opposed by some Christian groups who claimed it encouraged children to practice witchcraft. But now, with church attendance falling, many Christians are using Harry Potter as a way to talk about their faith. With the release of the latest Harry Potter movie this summer, James Carlton from God Forbid spoke to Jesuit priest Father Richard Leonard and Dr. Justine Toe from the Centre for Public Christianity to ask, what do Harry Potter and the Bible have in common?
I think they are both looking at very similar things. And if you think about the theme of remorse in The Deathly Hallows, which is the last book of the series, Snape feels remorse when Lily dies. And then when Harry says to Voldemort, you know, try for some remorse at all the lives that you've killed, at the way that you've lived your life, because I've seen what happens to you if you don't. You don't have any remorse.
So is there any difference between learning about remorse in Harry Potter and learning about it in the Bible?
Oh, there's a huge difference. But in some ways, maybe if you're familiar with the Harry Potter understanding of remorse, then something like repentance in the Christian tradition doesn't seem so alien either. And even though it is a fantastical context, the human interactions are very similar to our world. And so we can see how repentance might make more sense. Repentance can seem really alien for people, but when they've encountered it in Harry Potter, there might be at least a shared kind of language, a shared understanding of what that might look like.
Richard Leonard?
I think this is all about intertextuality, that one text relies and reveals another text.
Does that mean they're both as good as each other?
No, well, it depends on who's reading the text. As a Christian, I wouldn't think that Harry Potter comes anywhere close to the New Testament or the Old Testament. I approach the Bible as a sacred text, as a text necessary for my salvation. Now, I imagine atheists and agnostics and secular humanists listening to us right now would not approach the Bible like that. They're perfectly entitled not to. But similarly, I don't know anybody who's given their life for Harry Potter. I know plenty of people have given their lives for Jesus Christ. I don't know anybody who claims that Harry Potter has, well, they could have changed their life, actually. This is where these texts are very important because they form values. I think Harry Potter is one of the greatest meditations on discernment I've ever seen or read in my life, where you have to work out which voice to listen to. The whole series of books and films is all about how Harry has to navigate what voice to listen to, who to trust, who not to trust, temporary alliances, people, his friends, his true friends. It's all tested. You've got to go back again and again. These are profoundly wonderful contemporary allegories on some very ancient wisdom contained in other sacred and other narrative texts. And I just think J.K. Rowling is absolutely brilliant.
But there is this fundamental distinction between the sacred text and
a general narrative text. Shakespeare was full of very similar dichotomies and resolutions, and we've been very happy to celebrate that, and so we should. That doesn't put them on a level of a sacred or revealed text, but it does say they're important texts, and they're increasingly important as organised religion going and attending its religious services on the wane, these things are filling a gap.
And you don't object to that because, as a Christian, wouldn't you believe that we're born in sin and you can only be saved through the forgiveness of Jesus Christ, whereas Harry Potter is just a fantasy book?
It is a fantasy book, but it's also one that reveals truth.
But it won't get you into heaven.
Well, I think living the values of it might get you into heaven. For a good number of people who don't believe in God, they've sometimes got very good reason not to believe in God because of the way they've seen it lived. And so how do we believe God's utter, compassionate, merciful, loving justice and judgment might occur? What's their life like? And if their life has been infused by a narrative source which tells them that truth is better than lies and good is better than evil, then that's a pretty good formation.
Justine, what Richard says seems attractive. It seems universally applicable. But, and forgive me, Richard, for me saying this, it does seem to undercut the singular significance
of the Bible
to Christians.
Well, I was just reflecting as you guys were talking. C.S. Lewis, I think, was convinced by Tolkien, J.R. Tolkien, that the Christian story was the true myth. And so there was like a God who died and then rose again. It wasn't just a story that you just longed for a happy ending. The happy ending did transpire. So I think if you can be captivated by that possibility the way that Lewis was, and Lewis, of course, wrote Narnia as a way to try and express that to other people, then there's something very powerful there. It doesn't mean that you would then substitute Narnia or Harry Potter for your Bible, sacred text, but that one can just kind of be a stepping stone to another. And a gateway drug, if you like.
And also The Lord of the Rings. Tolkien was an explicit believer and Lewis came to be a believer. We're in the world of allegory here and it's a very rich world. And the worst thing the Christians can do is run from that. It always made me very sad that there were many, including in my own Catholic Church, Cardinal Ratzinger was one long before he became the Pope, and there was the chief exorcist for the Vatican who came out and condemned Harry Potter as being flirtation with witchcraft and wizardry was wrong and all of these things. I think this gets dangerous when we get that literal, that you can't have a lively, imaginative world in which, in cosmic terms, we can start to deal with some of these things, and particularly children can enter into it. And once you say that you can't look at wizards and warlocks, then Aesop's fables are out, Shakespeare's gone, certainly Macbeth, because we've got witches in there, Tolkien's gone, and so C.S. Lewis. Now, what an impoverished imagination, Christian or otherwise, would there be if you started to exclude all of these literary sources simply because they don't tell it the way the Bible says it?
And by that same measure, the Bible would be conceived to be forbidden literature with its tales of, you know, incest. Yeah, all the terrible things that go on in the Bible.
Yeah, well, the Bible itself is already a library of different styles of books. Mm. And one of the great traditions in the Bible is the mythological literature, is the mystical literature.
That conversation has certainly put Harry Potter and other stories in a new light. That was Father Richard Leonard and Dr. Justine Toe speaking with James Carlton on God Forbid. For decades, American politics has been shifting to the right. Of course, political trends come and go, but since the 1980s, the trend has generally been towards a more conservative type of politics. So what's been happening with the US political left? How should we understand Bernie Sanders, a professed socialist, who almost gained the Democratic nomination in 2016? Or the recent election of young people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who also happily call themselves socialists? Are we about to see the resurgence of left-wing ideas in American politics? Over two programs, Annabelle Quince from Rear Vision traces the rise and fall of the radical left in the United States. Here's an excerpt from part one, which looks at the early 19th century when Republicans were considered the radicals.
The idea of socialism has been called un-American, and yet, paradoxically, in the 19th century, America was the greatest socialist experimentation center in the world.
Christopher Phelps, one of the authors of Radicals in America, a comprehensive history of the American left since the Second World War.
It was a place where the followers of Robert Owen from England, the followers of Charles Fourier from France, put into practice these ideas of how to have an intentional community that would socialize production and property and share in the abundance of wealth produced by the community. And a lot of them were immigrants, people like Francis Wright, who was a follower of Owen and a utopian socialist and also a feminist and also anti-slavery. And there are a lot of different strands going on in the radicalism of that period, including abolitionism, which has its own dynamics and comes out of Protestant Christianity and the idea that we're all equal in the eyes of God, which then got extended to slavery as slavery being a sin. And as a lot of women who were often active in the church began to be active in the abolitionist movement, they confronted the idea that they couldn't publicly speak, that they couldn't be politically active, and the modern feminist movement is born. I mean, the first women's rights convention in 1848 was in the United States. So there's a whole efflorescence of radicalisms that are interrelated in the early 19th century.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things.
The Civil War was not over the question of slavery's existence initially. It was over the question of whether slavery would expand westward. Lincoln and the Republican Party were on record against slavery's expansion. And the South took that to be a indication that eventually there would be a move against slavery itself, and they seceded from the Union. And so the Civil War was fought by the North initially just to preserve the Union. But in the course of the war, it became an anti-slavery war because of the activity of slaves themselves. The fact that abolitionism had seeded a lot of thinking among what were called the radical Republicans was very important. And it's those radical Republicans in Congress who are liberated to take leadership once the South is withdrawn and the Southerners are no longer in Congress, who pass the 13th Amendment that abolishes slavery and the 14th and 15th Amendments that extend civil rights regardless of race and voting rights regardless of race.
And in that period, you really do see radical ideas being extended much more by, say, the Republican Party than perhaps the Democratic Party.
Yes, the Republican Party's militant civil rights wing was the leading force for human rights in that period. In fact, they're the ones that put through the 14th Amendment, which has what's now being derided as birthright citizenship, the idea that anyone born in the United States is a citizen of the United States, because if you're going to grant equal rights to all citizens, you have to define citizen, and that had not been done in the Constitution before. And so those Reconstruction amendments are extremely radical. They completely transform the nature of the Constitution. They completely transform America, because a country that was founded with slavery protected by the Constitution now has slavery forbidden by the Constitution. A country that was founded in a way that didn't really define citizenship and often restricted it de facto to propertied white men ends up extending it to all, regardless of color.
The radical nature of the Republican Party was, however, based on theological principles. As Robin Archer, author of Why There Is No Labor Party in the United States, explains.
One has to remember that the Republican Party was born from that conflict. So in that conflict, the Republican Party emerges as the party of evangelical, if you like, neo-Puritan activists, and their main issue is the terrible sin of slavery. And it's easy to forget now that what was driving activists, anti-slavery activists, in many cases, powerfully, were these theological concerns. They thought that the second coming can't happen if this terrible sin is still in place. So the Republican Party is profoundly affected by the idea that you should get a hold of state power to make society more godly. And good on them, they got rid of slavery. But there were other sins. There were saloons. There was Sabbath desecration. There was different ways of doing schooling. And once they dealt with slavery, they turned to those issues. The Democratic Party turned around and said, look, we're the party of personal liberty. So in the North, they said, look, it doesn't matter to us whether you're an Irish Catholic or a Protestant or a Methodist or a Jewish person. It doesn't matter. That's for you to decide. The state shouldn't be policing your moral opinions. If you want to drink beer, that's fine. If you don't, that's fine. It's your choice. And you can see that issue runs through American politics to this day. I mean, why is abortion such a powerful issue dividing the parties? It's driven by the same sorts of concerns. So that's the division that's in place from the middle of the 19th century.
That was Robin Archer, the director of the postgraduate program in political sociology at the London School of Economics and emeritus fellow in politics at Oxford. Part two of Rear Vision series can be heard tomorrow, that's Sunday, after the midday news or any time online. Black holes have to be some of the strangest structures in the universe. They warp time and space, they're so dense that they have no size, and their gravitational fields are so strong that not even light can escape from them. Just about every galaxy has a huge black hole right at its centre, including our very own Milky Way, as Dr. Carl explains in this week's episode of Great Moments in Science.
This is the problem. Take a pair of scales of the old-fashioned type into one tenth of the world.
G'day, Dr. Carl here. Now, we've had telescopes for about four centuries, but only recently have we managed to make one so impressively accurate that if we aimed it at the moon, we could read the time on a kitchen clock. And using this telescope, we've collected images of super-hot and super-fast objects orbiting the supermassive black hole at the centre of our galaxy. Wow, super work, super telescope. Now, scientists have been thinking about black holes for over two centuries. So, what are they? Well, before I begin, just a quick warning. This is going to get pretty dense pretty quickly. Okay, fair warning. Here we go. Every astronomical body has mass, and the mass gives it gravity. If the mass gets bigger, so does the gravity. At some stage, the gravity gets so massive that not even light can escape from it. And light travels at a colossal 300,000 kilometers per second. Today, we call such a body a black hole. Way back in 1784, the English clergyman and astronomer John Michell wrote a scientific letter about this concept. After a few centuries of theories and observations, we found our very first black hole in 1972. And since then, we've found them everywhere, and surprisingly, practically every galaxy seems to have an enormous black hole at its centre. In fact, one of these supermassive black holes, which is about 4 million times heavier than our Sun, is in the centre of our very own galaxy, the Milky Way. Now, notice that I did not say that this supermassive black hole was 4 million times bigger than our Sun. The reason that I did not use the word bigger is that all black holes have the same size, wait for it, which is zero. That's right, it doesn't matter if a black hole is 5 times the mass of our Sun, or 5,000, or 5 million, or 5 billion, they all have the same size of zero. Despite their physical lack of size, black holes have so much mass that they curve the very fabric of space-time. So much so that every possible path in or close enough to one of these objects leads to inside the black hole. In the real world of planet Earth, you can travel north or south or east or west. But with a black hole, you're stuck. So size is not one of the properties of a black hole. But we do have very good grounds for thinking that they do have three measurable properties. We've already heard that every black hole has mass, but these bizarre structures can also have spin and charge. That means that there are actually four different types of black holes. Your basic black hole has only mass. Number 2 has mass, and it spins. Number 3 has mass, and an electrical charge. And the last one, the number 4 black hole, has mass, plus spin, plus an electrical charge. Now, what do we know about how black holes interact with other objects? Well, if our Sun were to suddenly convert into a simple black hole, about the only major change would be that the Sun would no longer pump out any heat or light into the solar system. The Sun would go black, but all the planets would still continue to orbit in exactly the same paths that they had before the Sun turned into a black hole. They would not get sucked in. We wouldn't see a bright Sun, but there would be this point in the middle of our solar system which had no size, but which had the mass of our Sun. As you get closer to this point, the gravitational field would quite rapidly increase. And when you were about 3 kilometres from this point, the black hole, then quite suddenly, the gravitational field would become so strong that not even light could escape. We call this zone the event horizon. Outside the event horizon of a black hole, well, you can orbit quite comfortably. But once you are inside the event horizon, there is no coming back. Now, it turns out that the size of an event horizon is based on the mass of the black hole. Let's keep it simple and stick to the basic black hole that has mass, but does not spin and does not have an electrical charge. In this instance, if the black hole has a mass that is 5 times bigger than the Sun, its event horizon is 5 times bigger. 5,000 times the mass means the event horizon is 5,000 times bigger. It's just a straight, linear relationship. And so, the supermassive black hole in the centre of our galaxy has an event horizon that is about 4 million times the event horizon of our Sun, if the Sun were to turn into a black hole. That works out to about 24 million kilometres across. It's huge! And it gives us an idea of just how massive this black hole is. Now, using our telescopes over the last few decades, we have seen both stars and super-hot gas flying in orbits that bring them very close to the event horizon of the supermassive black hole in the middle of our galaxy. And this has taught us a huge amount about the nature of black holes. But I'll talk more about that next time.
What does it mean? Why is it so?
And to hear more about that mammoth black hole at the centre of our galaxy, make sure you subscribe to the Great Moments in Science podcast or visit the website via ABCRN. When was the last time you saw a flamingo in a zoo in Australia? Chances are it was decades ago. One by one they died until the last one at Adelaide Zoo left us earlier this year. On RN documentary program Earshot, Joe Koning tells the story of Chile, Australia's last flamingo. Here's a taste of the story.
I'm Lynette. I'm a veterinary nurse.
Lynette, for the last 4 years, has been looking after Chile. And she was there, treating her towards the end.
It was about, where were we, end of April. The keeper did the usual, go the lock away in the morning, and Chili was kind of unconscious and cold on the ground. And this is kind of what undoes most flamingos. They get bad arthritis in their legs, and then they get down, can't get back up again. So the keepers brought her straight up here. We warmed her up, gave her oxygen, and she became responsive really quickly after that. Because, however, she still wasn't able to use her legs, we put her in hospital in a sling. First couple of days, she couldn't have cared less. She was eating, doing all the right things. Unfortunately, she went off of her food after a couple of days. And one day, she'd got a bit in a bit of a mess, as a bird in a sling is going to be. So I thought, look, we'll put you in a warm bath. As soon as I put her in the trough, she came very animated and splashed around. And that actually seemed to help a little bit with the legs, and she was a bit more settled after that. However, at day 7, there had been no change in her ability to support herself, so they decided to euthanize her.
It's probably one of the toughest decisions you have to make. And what you do need to do is to weigh up in fairness that the decision needs to be what's best for the animal.
On Friday, the 6th of April, Chili had her last day at the Adelaide Zoo. It was a warm spring day. The keepers gathered in a sunny spot in the back of the zoo. Lynette had set up a warm bath for Chili, and they all crowded round.
All said hello to her and had a chat. We got her out and sat her in the sun, and she had a bit of a preen and sit there. And we all sat around and shared some nice stories of our times with Chili and what they remember. And rather than in mourning, feeling a bit more celebratory of her life, if that makes sense.
Then a vet injected Chili with a sedative to send her to sleep before she was given an overdose of anaesthetic.
The public had got wind of it that night before, and they'd been leaving flowers, and the children had been leaving drawings of Chili outside of her exhibit saying, "You were my favourite thing here, Chili. I always wanted to see you first." It's just like, you know, it's just a little flamingo, but the outpouring of sympathy, I think, and gratefulness that she had been here for so long and so many people had got to meet her, it became very evident, and how iconic she was to so many people in Adelaide.
Joe Koning there, and you can hear more about Chili the flamingo, taxidermy, and whether flamingos can feel loneliness on Earshot. Just look for the Earshot podcast on the ABC Listen app. When you think of soldiers leaving home for the First World War, do you imagine them leaning out of a train window? And do you imagine a woman at the station watching them go, holding a handkerchief in her hand and her heart in her mouth? This scene is so familiar it's become a cliche. But it wasn't made up. It actually happened to a young English woman called Vera Brittain, who penned the scene in her 1933 book Testament of Youth. Brittain was a middle-class woman ready for university when her world was turned upside down by the First World War. Her fiancé, two best friends and brother were all killed. To appease her grief, she became a nurse up to her elbows in mud and blood. Mark Bostridge is Vera Brittain's biographer. Here he is speaking to Kate Evans from The Bookshelf about both the woman and the long-lasting impact of her memoir.
I think Testament of Youth, first of all, is to my mind the greatest book of love, loss and remembrance to emerge from the war. It's also probably the greatest book by a woman about the war. I mean, there had been a lot of books written about the war by women, both during the war and in the 1920s, but this one really struck a chord. And thirdly, I suppose, and it's a claim that Vera Brittain herself made for the book, it presents the book from many different perspectives. Unlike the books by men, which generally tend to be about war service, being stuck in some part of the line and seeing only a very small part of the war, Vera Brittain was a nurse who had served in 5 or 6 hospitals, two abroad and one in France that was very close to the front line. She also, in the book, incorporated the letters from 4 young men she was very close to, her fiancé, her younger brother and 2 close friends. So you get the young officer's experience. And then there's the experience, which is not very well represented in writing about the First World War, of simply being a civilian at home and enduring all the privations that obviously grew during the period 1914 to 18.
And how self-conscious was she of the importance or the difference of that, telling the story of women's lives, telling the story of the home front? Like, how aware was she that this was something that really was quite different?
Well, I think when you talk about a woman's voice, she was very anxious to see women's war experience properly represented, because all the books by men, by Sassoon, Graves and Blunden in Britain, which in part she imitated because it was their success that made her think of writing her own story as an autobiography. but she saw no real representation of women's war service in those male books, and she was very keen to put that right.
And yet, when I called it there in shorthand, a memoir of the war and its aftermath, in a way that's a bit annoying, isn't it? Because it's more than that.
Well, she grew up, I mean, she was born in 1893, so she was at school in the first years of the 20th century, at exactly the time in Britain when the women's suffrage campaign was growing to a crescendo. And so the first part of the book is about the emancipation of a young woman in the years immediately before the war. A woman who is middle class, who comes from a wealthy background, but nevertheless wants to go to university, wants to get an education for herself. And in the years before the war, it was still relatively unusual for a woman in Britain to want to go to university if she came from a moneyed background, because the kind of women who went to university in those years were women who would have to earn their living as governesses or teachers. And Vera Brittain was very intellectual, very clever, and wanted to go to Oxford University. And so the first part of the book is about that struggle to get there. Of course, the second part of the book, which is about the war and her involvement as a volunteer nurse, sees her giving up that education temporarily. She decides to leave Oxford after a year in order to serve as a voluntary aid detachment nurse, partly as an imitation of the example of the young men in her life who have all joined up as second lieutenants and subalterns. So that's the second part of the book. And then the third part of the book is the story of her post-war life up until her marriage in 1925. And it's a story, in a sense, of a woman rebuilding her life after great loss and bereavement, because she's lost the four young men in the war. And it's also the story of a woman who's beginning both a campaigning life and the life as a writer, because Vera Brittain started after the war as a speaker for the League of Nations Union, determined that there shouldn't be another war. And she also published her first novel in 1923.
So she comes across in the book as a young woman who's oppressed by all sorts of expectations on her, just wanting to run headlong into the world. There's a real energy and vividness about her in Testament of Youth.
Yes, and sometimes people say that they find her admirable, but they don't necessarily like her very much, because I suppose she's very forceful. She's sometimes rather priggish. But I always say to these people, well, I mean, if you want to change the world, as Vera Brittain did, because in the latter part of her life, she was a major feminist figure in Britain, and even more, a major pacifist figure in Britain, especially during the Second World War. And if you want to shake up the world and change its values, you're not necessarily always going to be likable. But I think there is something very invigorating for the reader to realise, and this was certainly true when the film was made, the film of Testament of Youth that was released in 2015, that the young actors who played the parts had no idea of how restricted a young middle-class woman's life was before the First World War. The fact that when Vera Brittain went up to Oxford as a student, she had to be chaperoned if she was ever in male company. The very idea that her parents had, especially her father, that she shouldn't go to university, but that she should instead make a good marriage. This is what was expected of women.
And so it really demonstrated the ways in which the war crashes into everything.
Absolutely. I mean, it crashed into her life, changed her life completely. I don't think she would have been, and this is ironic, obviously, given the suffering the war brought her, I don't think she would have been as great a writer or written one really great book had it not been for the war.
And as well as working to change the world, this is also a story about work, isn't it? I mean, she dipped her hand in blood, didn't she?
Yes. She, as I said, went to Etap in 1917 and served there for 9 months. And while she was there, she worked in a German ward. She worked in a ward containing German prisoners of war, many of whom were dying, and nursed them. And it was a very bloody experience. But also, as I said, she came from such a sort of sheltered background that actually just seeing a male body of looking after young soldiers and having to do all sorts of things for them, washing them and so on and so forth, was a really an eye-opening experience for her.
It is also so profoundly a story of grief. Who did she lose?
Her first loss was the second Christmas of the war, Christmas 1915, when the young man who she had fallen in love with just before the outbreak of the war, Roland Layton, was shot by a sniper in France. That was the first loss. Then in April 1917, by which time Vera Brittain is serving as a VAD in Malta, she learns first of the loss of Geoffrey Thurlow, who was a friend of hers she'd met through her brother, and then even more devastatingly of the blinding at Arras of her close friend who'd been at school with her brother and Roland Layton, Victor Richardson. And she actually left Malta and returned to England with the intention of marrying Victor to help him through his disablement. But then when she got back to England, he died within a few weeks. And then finally, the loss, which was the most devastating and the one she never really got over, was the death of her younger brother, Edward, in the final months of the war in Italy. Edward had been a sort of family hero. He'd served with great distinction at the Battle of the Somme in 1916 and won the Military Cross for that. And then his battalion had gone to Italy in the final year of the war, and he was killed on the 15th of June 1918.
So close to the end.
I mean, she, as she said, in 1968, marking the 50th anniversary of his death in her diary, she had never stopped thinking of Edward at every turn in her life.
Just what sort of impact did this book have?
I think it gave people a voice, especially a voice to all the women who had lost husbands, sons, fiancés in the war. And one of the extraordinary things is, in the weeks after publication in Britain in August 1933, is the extraordinary number of letters that Vera Brittain received from women and from men who had fought or had shared some of these experiences, thanking her for being the spokesman for their generation, which was very much the way she saw herself. I actually, just the other day, I was clearing my mother's garage and I found a whole pile of letters, and this is a kind of parallel 50, 60 years on from the original publication, because when the BBC did their magnificent adaptation, television adaptation at the end of the 70s, Shirley Williams, Vera Brittain's daughter, also received an enormous number of letters from survivors of the war who were still alive, who again were very grateful that their experience was being represented.
Mark Bostridge, convince people who might not pick up a book written in 1933 why they should read Vera Brittain's Testament of Youth.
Well, we're in 2018. We're in November 2018. It's 100 years since the end of the First World War. And so I think it's time, perhaps a time when a lot of people will want to turn their thoughts to their own families and what their own families in the past may have suffered through this terrible war. And I can't think of any book that brings home the First World War experience more devastatingly, more movingly, more vividly than Testament of Youth. And in illustration of this, with an Australian bias, I was contacted the other day, because I am responsible for running Vera Brittain's literary estate, by the Anzac Memorial, asking if they could use quotations from Vera Brittain and Testament of Youth and some of Vera Brittain's war poetry in the merchandise they sell at the Anzac Memorial. So you can see how the story stretches across nations now, and it's a universal story of loss, bereavement, and of someone rebuilding their life.
Mark, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Biographer Mark Bostridge on the life and significance of writer and peace activist Vera Brittain, author of Testament of Youth. He was speaking with Kate Evans for The Bookshelf. Three paraplegic men are walking again thanks to breakthrough treatment by Swiss scientists. The men were able to move after electrical stimulation to their spinal cords was applied. The results from the successful research have been published in the journal Nature, and Australian researchers say it's only a matter of time before the treatment is available here. But they also caution against expectations becoming too high. For the Health Report, here's Joe Kahn.
David Mzee's legs were paralysed in a sporting accident in 2010. Now he's back on his feet 8 years later.
One of the key moments, I would say, was when I started walking hands-free on the treadmill.
a lot of bodyweight support, but really letting the bars go and do one, two, three steps without using my hand was really crazy because I just couldn't do it before and it wouldn't work without stimulation.
He's one of three paraplegic patients surgically implanted with stimulators to activate the spinal cord with an electrical pulse. The stimulator targets the region of the spinal cord that can control leg muscles in order to walk. Professor Grégoire Courtine led the research at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology.
With the stimulation, that is very targeted, we really stimulate the region of the spinal cord that the brain is also trying to activate. And what you observe, someone who is completely paralyzed or severely affected, when we apply this targeted electrical stimulation of the spinal cord, is able to walk voluntarily for fairly extensive period of time. And then what has been very surprising to us, that when you start training with the stimulation, after 2-3 months, they could start walking hands-free.
Yeah. Yeah. Three steps. Okay, let's make four.
With the electrical stimulation, their body weight partially supported by a harness and watched closely by the team of doctors and scientists, the patients were able to take steps for the first time since their spinal cord injuries. But their recovery went even further than that.
All our participants regained voluntary control over their previously paralyzed muscles without the electrical stimulation, suggesting that there is a growth of new nerve connection in response to this treatment. So, you know, when two neurons fire together, they establish new connections.
For this reconnection of neural pathways to occur, there have to be surviving but dormant connections still there, which is more likely to occur in patients with an incomplete spinal cord injury, which means some motor and sensory function is preserved below their injury. Dr. Sylvia Gustin from Neuroscience Research Australia said the new research was exciting for the spinal cord injury community.
I don't think it's a miracle, but I think it's an incredible and cutting-edge progress in spinal cord injury research. This was done in people with an incomplete injury. These people, they can partially move and feel. So what they have done, they have enhanced the surviving spinal and motor pathways, so that in some way the brain can talk again to the periphery, to the legs. And at the end, what the wonderful thing is that these people were then able to voluntarily walk.
Professor Courtine also emphasizes that the treatment is not a miracle cure.
This is not the magic pill. This is intense training, and without the will to recover, it would not work. We basically provide the tool to help the brain help itself. Then the rest is in the end of our patients.
But he said the research could also assist in recovery for people with complete spinal cord injuries. Neuroscientist Professor Bryce Vissel from the University of Technology Sydney says the research is a significant development towards treatment for people with spinal cord injuries.
This study is adding incredible weight and a major step forward. Now we're in a stage of this is real. People with spinal cord injury no longer need to call this false hope. No, this is real hope. What we don't know is how it's going to work in every single patient, what kind of patients are going to respond the best. You know, there's a lot of tweaking to do now to work out who, where, how and why. But the principle is now established beyond reasonable doubt. It's going to continue to get better and better.
And he says the treatment could soon be trialled in Australia.
What you're seeing in that paper is going to be available in a research sense in Australia in the next year, which is really phenomenal. For some of the people who come into the experiments here in Australia, they will be seeing recovery that was never imagined possible, and we believe it can be rolled out in a very real way within the next 3 to 5 years.
Professor Courtine and his team will now start trialling the treatment more widely.
We have sufficient evidence to bring this treatment in the early stage after a spinal cord injury, when the potential for growth of new connection is incredibly larger than in the chronic stage, and also the neuromuscular system have not yet undergone all the atrophy that follows chronic paralysis.
You've been working in this area for about 15 years now. How did it feel to you personally when you saw these patients walking for the first time?
We went outside by the lake here in Switzerland with one of our participants who was bound to wheelchair for 7 years, and you just walk like this for 500 meters with a stimulation. That's a moment you will never forget in your life.
That was Professor Courtine from the Centre for Neuroprosthetics at the Swiss Federal Institute for Technology. Ending that story by Joe Kahn from the Health Report. And that's it for In Case You Missed It this week. If you'd like to hear any of our previous programs, just head to our webpage or download our podcast from the ABC Listen app. I'm Angela Owens. I look forward to your company next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.